Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 892, the so-called Kennedy curse, unquote. This is being recorded on February 28th of the year 2016. Recently, there was a parole hearing, the 15th as it was, for Saran Saran, who was the patsy in the Robert Kennedy assassination. He, not surprisingly, was denied parole for the 15th time. And that is not surprising because we are, as a society, in the position that political comedian Mort Saul observed in his autobiography Heartland, published in 1976. Mort Saul asked, how many lies can you allow yourself to believe before you belong to the lie? And frankly, we here in America have allowed so many lies to become institutionalized and to achieve the level of accepted historical fact, and so many journalists, so many editors, so many commentators, so many professors and historians have subscribed to those lies that for America to confront the truth about its own history would not only go against the grain of the intelligence agencies, CIA in particular, but it would go fundamentally against the grain of our society. So many Americans are now earning their living by hoping to disseminate one lie or another, that sadly we have come to that state of affairs that Mort Saul ruminated about in 1976. By the way, Mort Saul was one of New Orleans DA Jim Garrison's investigators in his investigation of the JFK assassination. There is an article, one of many, in the Washington Post of February 11th of 2016, an article by Peter Holley, H-O-L-L-E-Y. Saran Saran denied parole despite a Kennedy confidant's call for the assassin's release. And skipping down about Union official Paul Schrade, again, a friend of Kennedy's, a political ally, and a man who was walking just behind Kennedy in the pantry of the Ambassador Hotel on June 5th, 1968, and who was wounded in the assassination. And yet when Schrade came face to face with Saran for the first time in nearly 50 years at a parole hearing in San Diego on Wednesday, he argued that the notorious gunman was not Kennedy's killer. But the panel wasn't swayed, and Saran was denied parole for the 15th time. Skipping down. The fatal bullets, Schrade argued, were fired from a different shooter's gun. Schrade believes that Saran perhaps accurately fired the shot that wounded him. However, since scientific tests have proved that there were at least 13 shots fired in the pantry, and since Saran's gun only held 8, there has to have been at least one second gunman. Beyond that, Coroner Thomas Noguchi, who performed the autopsy, testified and in fact has written that the fatal shot, the one that killed Robert Kennedy, was fired from a distance of less than 1 inch from the back of Robert Kennedy's head. The gun was so close that the entry wound, the flesh around the edge of the entry wound, was macerated from the force of the muzzle blast. And since this was a 22 caliber revolver, that was not a particularly, or 22 caliber pistol, that was not a particularly forceful blast. In AFA program number 9, recorded in June of 1985, we went through the various key elements of evidence and also the fact that Coroner Noguchi mentioned that unidentified Los Angeles Police Department officials put pressure on him to change his testimony. So whoever the actual assassin of Robert Kennedy was, whether it was Thane Eugene Caesar, as many believe, and I'm inclined to believe that allegation, or someone else, it certainly was not Saran. Saran was almost certainly a victim of mind control. He still cannot remember what happened that evening. And we would note that the two LAPD officials, Manuel Manny Pena and Enrique Hank Hernandez, both had long-standing connections to the U.S. intelligence apparatus and the CIA in particular. Manny Pena had also worked for the Dodd Committee that was investigating mail-order firearms. Many people feel that that committee, headed up by Thomas Dodd, was involved with manipulating Lee Harvey Oswald. There is discussion of that in a number of different For the Record programs, including For the Record 158, The Life and Times of Thomas Dodd. As noted in this article, skipping down, the newspaper noted that skeptics' arguments were seemingly bolstered by a 2007 analysis of an audio recording of the shooting. The analysis, the newspaper noted, quote, indicates a total of 13 shots fired, further strengthening the argument of those who believe a second gunman was involved, Kennedy's true assassin. Well, again, it is not in the least little bit surprising that Saran was once again denied parole. Again, how many lies can you allow yourself to believe before what you belong to the lie? And I'm afraid, sadly, here in America, we have arrived at that point. One of the ways in which our true history has been covered up is by mystifying it. The Kennedy family has befallen many tragedies, including, of course, the assassinations of both John and Robert Kennedy, and as we will see at the end, in the conclusion of this program, in all probability, the death and probable assassination of John F. Kennedy, Jr. But instead of taking a look at these events as being what they clearly are, which are the results of a malevolent conspiratorial process, instead we are being told that, well, the Kennedy family has a curse, as though this were 17th century Salem, Massachusetts, and there was witchcraft abroad, and that just is not the case. A very important, relatively recent book about the JFK assassination, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters, by James W. Douglas, published in software by Touchstone Books, goes into the murders of JFK and RFK and links the two. And we're going to delve into this right now. From JFK and the Unspeakable, we read, "The extent to which our national security state was systematically marshaled for the assassination of President John F. Kennedy remains incomprehensible to us. When we live in a system, we absorb a system and think in a system. We lack the independence needed to judge the system that is all around us. Yet the evidence we have seen points toward our national security state, the systemic bubble in which we all live, as the source of Kennedy's murder and its immediate cover-up. Intelligence agencies in that state have advantages over us ordinary citizens in controlling our government. The CIA, FBI, and their intelligence affiliates in the armed forces have resources and aspirations, as revealed by the president's assassination, that go far beyond our moral imagination. In his increasingly isolated presidency, JFK had a diminishing power over those agencies. Partly because of our naivete as citizens, he was killed by covert action agencies and the conspiracy covered up by them with relative ease and legal impunity. It was the beginning of a deadly process. Even before JFK's assassination took place, there was evidence that those in command of our security agencies may have already been thinking about whom they might have to kill next for the sake of the nation. A prime candidate was the president's brother, his possible successor in the White House in the years to come, Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy. On Thursday, November 21st, as John and Jacqueline Kennedy were arriving on Air Force One in Houston to begin their Texas tour, Wayne January, spelled just like the month, J-A-N-U-A-R-Y, was at Redbird Airfield in Dallas preparing a DC-3 aircraft for flight. In this narrative, we have already encountered January, who the day before had refused to charter a flight for November 22nd to a suspicious young couple accompanied by a man January later identified as Lee Harvey Oswald. Wayne January was working on the DC-3 all day Thursday with the pilot who was scheduled to fly it out of Dallas on Friday afternoon, the 22nd of November. It was their third day on the job, working together on a project they both enjoyed, preparing an extraordinary machine for flight. The two men had become friends. Wayne had also become curious about the background of his friend, who said he had been born in Cuba, although Wayne could detect no trace of an accent. The man said he had been in the Cuban Air Force, where he had risen to a high rank. Except for his work with January, the pilot kept totally to himself, refusing Wayne's invitations to eat out with him. The pilot confided himself to eating sandwiches with Wayne by the aircraft they were working on. Wayne became more curious. He asked the pilot about the well-dressed man who had bought the plane from a company January co-owned. The man had carried out the transaction with January's partner by phone. The buyer had made only one appearance at the airfield when he came with the pilot on Monday. The pilot described his boss as, quote, an Air Force colonel who deals with planes of this category, unquote. The colonel had bought the plane on behalf of a company known as the Houston Air Center, unquote. January would learn later that the Houston Air Center was a front for the CIA. As revealed by the plane's archived papers, the aircraft had originally been a troop transport version of the DC-3, known as a C-47, made in the Second World War and sold by the government to a private airline after the war. It was now being sold back to the government for use as a covert CIA aircraft. As Wayne and the pilot continued talking during their lunch break Thursday, Wayne suddenly found himself in the Twilight Zone, learning more about secret government operations than he ever wanted to know. The moment of transition came after a pause in their conversation. The other man sat leaning against the wheel of the aircraft, eating his sandwich. He was silent for a time, mulling over something in his mind. Then he looked up and said, "Wayne, they are going to kill your president," unquote. As Wayne January described this scene three decades later in a remarkable fact letter to British author Matthew Smith, he tried to convey his utter incomprehension of the man's words. When Wayne asked the pilot what he meant, the man repeated, "They are going to kill your president," unquote. Wayne stared at him. "You mean President Kennedy?" The man said yes. While Wayne kept trying to make sense of his words, his co-worker revealed that he had been a pilot for the CIA. He was with the CIA in the planning of the Bay of Pigs. When many of his friends died there, the planners and survivors of the operation bitterly blamed John and Robert Kennedy for not providing the air cover the CIA claimed they had promised. Wayne asked if that was why he thought they were going to kill the president. The man said, "They are not only going to kill the president, they are going to kill Robert Kennedy or any other Kennedy who gets into that position," unquote. Wayne thought he was beginning to catch on. His friend had gone off the deep end. Wayne tried to say so in a polite, circumspect way. The pilot looked at him. "You will see," he said. The two men went back to work. They were behind schedule with less than 24 hours left to complete the task. "My boss wants to return to Florida," the pilot said. There was room in the plane for more passengers than just his boss. Wayne, and the pilot were reinstalling 25 seats in it. The DC-3 had to be ready to take off from Dallas by early afternoon the next day, Friday, November 22nd. In the course of their work, the pilot made another memorable remark. "They want Robert Kennedy real bad," he said. "But what for?" Wayne asked. "Never mind," the man said. "You don't need to know." Thanks to the two men's joint efforts, they succeeded in having the plane ready to go early Friday afternoon. By 12:30 p.m., all the DC-3 lacked was fuel, and whoever would soon get aboard it to depart from Dallas. As they finished their work, there was a commotion by the terminal. A police car took off at high speed, wondering what was up. Wayne walked back to the terminal building. The driver of a passing car slowed down and shouted at him, "The president has been shot," unquote. Wayne went into the building. He listened to a radio until he heard the announcement that President John F. Kennedy was dead. He walked back to the DC-3. It had received its fuel. The pilot was putting luggage on the plane. Wayne asked him if he had heard what had happened. Without pausing from his loading, the pilot said he had. The man on the fuel truck had told him. And then he said, "It's all going to happen just like I told you." Wayne said goodbye to the pilot, and with a sense of profound sickness, he left work to find a television set where he could watch news of the president's assassination unfold. Until 1992, Wayne January lived alone with the nightmare of what the pilot had told him. Because of what he knew, he feared for his life and the lives of his wife and family. When the FBI and a few researchers asked him questions related to the assassination, he told them only about the couple with Oswald, whom he had turned down when they tried to charter a plane for Friday, the 22nd. Without his knowledge, the FBI then discredited him by dating the incident 4 months earlier, minimizing its importance, and making a more delayed Oswald identification seem less plausible. However, Wayne remained silent about the CIA pilot who knew the president was going to be killed, the colonel representing Houston Air Center, and the newly purchased CIA plane that took off from Redbird Airfield the afternoon of November 22nd. He also kept secret the pilot's prediction of what would happen to Robert Kennedy as fulfilled by his murder in June of 1968, quote, "and any other Kennedy who gets into that position," unquote. In 1992, Wayne January broke his silence about the pilot's revelation. As we have seen, author Matthew Smith had already interviewed him the year before about the couple with Oswald. After Smith showed him the FBI report that claimed falsely the incident occurred the previous July, the two men became good friends. January realized he had finally found someone he could trust with his long-held secret. He faxed to Smith at his home in Sheffield, England, a complete account of what the CIA pilot had said to him. Smith had been puzzled in Dallas at how January could be so sure in saying the CIA was behind the Kennedy assassination. Now, he knew. January told Smith that sending his fact statement after 30 years of silence, quote, seems to be a release of some kind that I don't understand, a relief that seems to make me more relaxed. It gave the British author permission to publish a story on the condition that he not be identified because, quote, he still feared for his life and for that of his wife, unquote. Smith agreed. He used a pseudonym for January's name and changed a few details to avoid identifying him. The story of Hank Gordon's experience with the CIA pilot at Redbird Airfield, that's the pseudonym that Matthew Smith gave Wayne January, beginning again, the story of, quote, Hank Gordon's, unquote, experience with the CIA pilot at Redbird Airfield, subsequently appeared in Matthew Smith's book, Vendetta, The Kennedys, 1993, and Say Goodbye to America, 2001. After Wayne January died in 2002, Smith obtained permission from his widow to reveal his name. He did so at a November 2003 conference in Dallas and in his book Conspiracy, The Plot to Stop the Kennedys. Thanks to Wayne January's friendship with a CIA pilot who risked confiding in him, and to January's deeper friendship with Matthew Smith, in whom he risked confiding, we can now see more than we may want to see. We can see a possible commitment to a chain of covert action murders that would extend from JFK to RFK and any other Kennedy liable to become president. Quote, "They are not only going to kill the president, they are going to kill Robert Kennedy and any other Kennedy who gets into that position." Unquote. The Kennedy family has been well aware since John F. Kennedy's murder as president, mirrored by Senator Robert F. Kennedy's murder as a presidential candidate, how dangerous it is for one of them to aspire to the presidency. Yes, indeed. That again from a very important book by James W. Douglas, JFK in the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. And we're also going to take note of something, and we've spoken about this in many past broadcasts, a very important recent book about Alan Dulles and the CIA and also the JFK assassination. Well, the book was recently published. It was authored by David Talbot, T-A-L-B-O-T. It's called The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA and the Rise of America's Secret Government. And it was published in hardcover by Harper in 2015. And in The Devil's Chessboard, there is discussion of how Robert Kennedy, who was running for president in 1968, had planned on reopening the investigation into his brother's murder after he was elected. The Garrison camp implored Kennedy to speak out about the conspiracy, arguing that such a public stand might even protect his own life by putting the conspirators on notice. But RFK preferred to play such deeply crucial matters close to the chest. He would reopen the case on his own terms, Kennedy confided to his closest aides, suggesting that day would come only if he won the executive powers of the White House. Well, of course, he never did. After winning the California primary, which certainly would have given him the 1968 Democratic nomination, and he would have beaten Richard Nixon like a gong in all probability, Robert Kennedy was, of course, assassinated. And again, whoever the actual trigger man was who killed Kennedy, I suspect, as do many assassination researchers, that it was security guard Thane Eugene Caesar, who was not only an American Nazi, but worked in the Lockheed Burbank facility that manufactured the U-2, among other things. Whether or not it was Thane Eugene Caesar, certainly the fatal shot could not have been fired by Saran. Saran was anywhere from 3 to 11 feet in front of Robert Kennedy, depending on which eyewitness one references. And also bear in mind that a struggle took place in the pantry, so it would not have been just one position, but no one places Saran closer to Robert Kennedy than 3 feet in front of him, most about 6 to 8 feet in front of him. The fatal shot was fired from a distance of less than 1 inch from the back of Robert Kennedy's head. And again, it was so close that the flesh around the entrance wound was macerated from the force of the muzzle blast. So whoever actually fired the fatal shot, it was not Saran, although the chances of his getting out, I think, are remote. For background information about the Robert Kennedy assassination, again, AFA program number 9, available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. A recent update for the record, program 789, tracks recent developments in that case. Shortly after the death of John F. Kennedy Jr. in a plane crash. The media immediately accepted the official version of, well, this was a tragic case, and John F. Kennedy Jr. was just another reckless Kennedy, and he died because of his recklessness, etc. When Kennedy died, not many asked questions. We were among those who asked questions, and in For the Record 175, Fortunate Son, Part 1, we interviewed John Bryan, B-R-Y-A-N, an alternative journalist, and this was about the death of John F. Kennedy Jr. in July of 1999. Note that, as Mr. Bryan will tell us, JFK Jr. was being openly discussed by the talking heads in Washington as a possible member of the 2000 Democratic presidential ticket, probably the vice presidential position. His charisma and his name almost certainly would have given the Democrats the victory. Remember what that unnamed CIA officer and pilot told Wayne January? They're not only going to kill the president, they are going to kill Robert Kennedy and any other Kennedy who gets into that position. Well, JFK Jr. was another Kennedy who was going to get into that position, and he was killed in that plane crash. This is from For the Record 175 from the summer of 1999.
Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to present veteran journalist John Bryan, who is opening a new alternative paper in San Francisco called Open City, and who's done some breathtaking work on the death of John F. Kennedy Jr. John, forgive the embarrassing intro, but I think you deserve the intro.
Well, thank you. Open City, by the way, is 35 years old. This is not the first issue. It's the 259th issue, and we just hit the streets with it, and I think people will enjoy it again.
All righty. Well,
to bring back the 60s issue.
Well, you're certainly opening up the publication with a very, very interesting and, to some no doubt, very controversial topic, which is the death of JFK Jr. But before
That's our lead story.
Before we get to that subject, if you would fill us in a little bit about your journalistic background so that listeners have some familiarity with you.
Well, I come from a newspaper family, and I started in as a copy boy in the San Diego Tribune and went to a little weekly down there. I got my real first break working for the Chandler Publishing Corporation in Los Angeles. They used to publish a afternoon paper called the Mirror News. I broke in on the Mirror News. Then I went down to Mexico City, worked a couple of papers down there, came up to Houston, worked the Houston Post, Houston Chronicle, both makeup editor. And came to San Francisco to go to work on the San Francisco Examiner, doing the local editing for what they call the Bulldog Edition, which is the Advanced Sunday Edition. I also was their jazz editor and general assignment reporter. Went on to the Chronicle for a year, covered court, City Hall. Went down to Los Angeles for 3 years on the Herald Examiner, which was then the biggest PM in America and Hearst's biggest paper. I was a Sunday editor, and when I quit them, I was editing the Rotogravura magazine. I quit to go back to the underground press, which is what I've always loved. I was managing editor of the LA Free Press. Then I started up Open City in LA after it had run 14 issues in San Francisco and then joined the Free Press. We also published in San Francisco the Sunday paper and the Phoenix and Appeal to Reason. So under one name or another, or as a section of these other papers, Open City is very old, 35 years old.
Now, your work on the San Francisco Examiner obviously gave you some working familiarity with their journalistic procedures.
Yes.
And it was an apparent discontinuity in these procedures that first got you sniffing the air from a journalistic standpoint on the JFK, on the
JFK Jr.
Yeah, the JFK Jr. popped
off. So many Kennedys get popped off, it's hard to keep track.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, that first got you looking into the death of JFK Jr. Tell us about it, if you would.
Well, I'm very familiar with the Saturday edition of the Examiner. The last job I had with them, I was working in the back shop, pasting up the Saturday edition, among others. I know that the deadline is 6 a.m. They only publish one on Saturday, the 4-star. Usually it goes to camera just about 6 a.m., 6:05, 6:10. Having made up those front pages a good many times, I knew exactly when they hit. As it happened that day, that Saturday, July 17th, I had relied on the Examiner as my sole news source. I wasn't listening to radio, I wasn't watching television, and I glanced through it, and there was nothing at all in there about John F. Kennedy Jr. A friend in Houston called me and asked me for my opinion that evening, and I said, what happened? It wasn't in the paper. And he said, well, Christ, it's the headline here. So I started, my ears went up as a journalist. This is a very important story. This was a man very prominent in the news.
The death of a president.
The nation's child, we used to call him. He was the one we all remember saluting his father's casket at the age of three after his father was assassinated in Dallas. The death of John F. Kennedy Jr., or even his disappearance, could certainly not be ignored. It was a major, major story. It might even be the story of the year by the time all this is done. So I immediately began to investigate. I checked my sources at the Examiner, people who still work down there, and they said something odd had happened. They weren't sure exactly what it was or why, but I checked Associated Press, both the San Francisco Bureau and New York, and I discovered that first of all, it was NBC News which broke the story at 5 a.m. Pacific Coast time on July 17th. The plane apparently had gone down around 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on July 16th. The break hit at 5 a.m. on Channel 7, which is, excuse me, not Channel 7, Channel 4, NBC, which is owned by the Chronicle. The Examiner and the Chronicle, like most newspapers today, have 12 or 14 television sets going constantly in the city room, one television tuned to each channel. So there were at least two people in that city room watching those television sets at 5 a.m. Plus they got, you know, all these other connections, telephones, their own bureaus in Washington and around the world. There's no way in the world by 5 a.m. they could not have known that John F. Kennedy's plane had gone down. They knew. They definitely knew.
How do you account for the delay then?
Well, I checked the story further. As I said, Associated Press told me that they sent an advisory at 5:13 a.m. Pacific time to their clients, which included the Examiner, telling them their major bulletin was coming. The bulletin on John F. Kennedy's disappearance hit the Examiner at 5:30 a.m. Pacific time. They technically still had half an hour. It takes about 5 minutes to pull the story sent by satellite out of the computer and get it typeset. So by 5:35, they could have had the type and they could have had it pasted up by, say, 5:45. Now, my friends in camera checked the log for me and they discovered that the page one Saturday did not come into camera until 6:42, 42 minutes late, which means they had plenty of time. They had an hour and 42 minutes from the time that the NBC broke the story. They had more than an hour from the time that the story was in their computers. So they had the story, they knew that it occurred, and they deliberately blanked the story. And why they blanked the story is what I'm trying to find out. I think a lot of people in Washington and around the world in high places know that there was foul play in the death of John F. Kennedy Jr. They know the truth. I think eventually it's going to come out. And I'm asking the question of these two questions of a lot of people that I meet, hundreds of people, including a lot of important people I've telephoned. Question number one, do you think there was foul play in the death of John F. Kennedy Jr.? It's question number two, if so, why? And generally, we also discuss the way the media has handled it.
John, in an article that's already been published in the Anderson Valley Advertiser...
The article has been published in three places now. The Anderson Valley Advertiser, the Los Angeles Free Press, and Open City, the 35th anniversary issue, which just hit the streets this week.
Three different papers,
and it's on the net.
You also point out a number, in that article, you point out a number of interesting discrepancies between the facts and the official story.
Right.
Let's get into those. Tell us about Kyle Bailey. Who was he and what did he have to reveal?
Well, the Kyle Bailey quotes came out of a very reputable source, the New York Times. Kyle Bailey was a pilot who used the airport, the Essex, New Jersey airport, from which John F. Kennedy Jr. flew that ill-fated day, July 16th. Bailey had flown the same kind of plane, Piper Saratoga, a $350,000 single-engine plane, which Kennedy was flying that day. Let me find the exact quote. Okay, just take me a second. He said that he was surprised by the manner in which Kennedy warmed up the plane and got ready to take off. and he thought there was something mechanically wrong with it, and he was going to warn Kennedy, but it was too late. The plane had already taken off. The other data, you want me to give you a quick rundown?
Well, one thing I want to point out, and you point out in your article, is that the plane was unguarded, that there was plenty of time for anybody who might have wanted to mess with it to do so, and that it also was completely anticipatable, to coin a term.
We had been going from Essex, New Jersey, 200 miles to Martha's Vineyard Island Airport every single Friday for months. It was predictable, just as predictable as rain.
You also point out that there are a lot of discrepancies in the official story. How far from Martha's Vineyard was he when he called the airport?
Well, let me run through a few of the discrepancies.
Sure,
okay.
Go ahead.
First of all, the fact of the matter that his Friday routine was so predictable. Secondly, he always flew with a flight instructor, but this particular week, the flight instructor suddenly had to go to Europe, and Kennedy had to fly by himself. Thirdly, Kennedy was known as a very careful pilot. He had put in more than twice the number of hours to get his flight permit. He was working on learning night instrumentation flying and was about to take his test in that area, so he was not completely deficient in knowledge of flying by instruments. He, as I already said, Bailey noted that there was something wrong with the plane. Exactly what, we're not sure, but it didn't sound right. Kennedy left late. His sister-in-law held him up, and he himself had trouble getting in there in time. So it was getting dark sooner than normally on his flights. He was about 15 miles out from Martha's Vineyard Airport when he was flying about 120 miles an hour. When he notified Martha's Vineyard that he was coming in for a landing, perfectly normal voice, no mayday or warning of any trouble, Martha's Vineyard gave him the go-ahead. He was, from that point he was about 7.5 miles from Martha's Vineyard. The weather was excellent. There was no rain, there was no hail, there was no snow, there were no strong winds. Visibility was 2 to 5 miles, a little bit of haze on the island, but not much. And he could easily see the lights of the landing field.
So at seven and a half miles out, the
plane suddenly disappeared, just went down into the sea. Now, there were eyewitnesses on television, on Channel 7, who said they saw the plane coming in at about 100 feet. And there was one witness who claims he saw it at the moment it disappeared. He saw a big flash of white light, like an explosion. The plane sank approximately 7.5 miles from Martha's Vineyard, about 4 minutes out. Now, since he had already notified the landing field he was coming in, and it was a perfectly flat terrain, sandy island terrain, he would not be coming in at 1,800 feet. He'd be coming in at about 100. That'd be normal, 4 minutes from landing. The FAA, on the other hand, is claiming that he was at 1,800 feet, and the reason that the plane came apart so radically was because it hit so hard. Well, they're giving you strange figures, like the plane was supposedly flying 5,000 feet a minute, which sounds very, very big, but if you translate that into miles, he was driving about the speed of a car on a freeway, 60 miles an hour. A
couple of details I want to point out.
A lot of these facts just simply don't add up.
A couple of details before you go on. The Piper Saratoga has been reported by veteran pilots, and they were quoted in the papers as being a very, very stable aircraft, one that doesn't like to be. Yeah, it is one which, with any kind of decent pilot, will be able. They can get them out of a spiral like that. Also, I would point out that the paper said that John F. Kennedy had fewer than 100 hours flying time. Some said he had as few as 35. In fact, it later came out that he was a lifelong aviation buff with over 300 hours of flying time.
He had done more than double the number of hours needed.
And again,
to get his permit.
A few of the details that you've related. First of all, the weather wasn't hazy.
The weather was great.
The weather was
great. The only thing wrong was it was dark. I mean, it's always dark at night.
Yeah, and he had called Martha's Vineyard Airport, gotten clearance to land, was 7.5 miles or about 4 minutes from the airport.
That's right.
With a visibility of 2 to 5 miles. And there is no credible explanation as to why he would be at 1,800 feet when he was coming into land. One of the things that first...
Well, the other thing, by the way, the first report into the FAA that the plane was missing came about half an hour after it disappeared, after 10 p.m. I guess it was an airport employee on Martha's Vineyard, called the FAA and said the plane did not come in. And the FAA said, we are not even watching the flight. We don't care about it. He didn't file a flight plan. He's a private citizen. He's of no interest to us, and we're not at all concerned about it. Later, they say they have recordings of radar scope which show him coming in at 1,800 feet and going to the spiral. I would like to see those radar scope recordings. I don't think they exist.
From a scientific standpoint, in terms of scientific methodology, the thing that first got me sniffing there, other than the fact that it was President Kennedy's son, was the fact that for days they were saying, we don't know what happened, we don't know where it is. It was all this
rumination. It took 5 days to find the plane.
But throughout those 5 days, there was rumination about where it might be, what had happened, this and that, and then they produce a radar track purporting to be of the plane saying, this is what happened, this is where and this is when. They should have known.
All of a sudden, there was, the White House took control of all press information, and there was an official story. And the official story blamed the said it was an accident. It was no foul play. Said that the whole thing was the fault of John F. Kennedy Jr. himself and his ineptitude as a nighttime flyer who did not know how to use instruments, and that he's because of the lack of instruments he had gone into what they call the dead man's spiral. And it crashed. And this was the official story. The as usual, the American press corps did not question it in any way. I think an investigation is called for. I don't believe the story at all.
Let me just underscore that the coverage as it was relayed, we don't know what happened, we don't know where it is, or all this searching, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then the official version that said, well, here's this plane, here's the radar track, are mutually contradictory. They either knew or they didn't know where the plane was, and the two are in fundamental contradiction.
Well, the first report was that they did not know and they did not care. He had filed no flight plan, and they were not tracking him. They'd paid no attention to him. Now, the other thing, there are two other things of great importance here. I paid a lot of attention to television direct the couple of days immediately after the disappearance of the plane. I was watching TV news constantly on July 17th and July 18th. On July 17th, there was coverage from Martha's Vineyard, from the Kennedy compound, or Hyannisport, rather, that's where the compound is, the Kennedy family was now making plans for burial of John F. Kennedy Jr. and his wife and his sister-in-law, and they were going to put John F. Kennedy Jr. in Arlington Cemetery as near as possible to the grave of his father. The other thing that broke after the three bodies and a fetus were found, two Democratic congressmen, this is television coverage, two Democratic congressmen who were at Hyannisport commented that this was more of a tragedy than the nation understood because the left side of the Democratic Party was planning to offer the nomination for either president or vice president to John F. Kennedy Jr. at the convention in the year 2000. Now, this would make him a very important political figure and would give somebody a good motive for killing him.
John, you cite some very
also one more thing in the Sunday talking heads shows, like Meet the Press. A number of reputable journalists, political experts, said that it was common knowledge in Washington and had been for months that John F. Kennedy Jr. was going to be offered the nomination.
And again, from stated sources, my guess is he probably would have gotten vice president rather than president, but that's an educated guess.
I don't think Al Gore's got a chance in hell.
Well, that's a separate subject. We're low on time.
I
agree with you as far as it goes.
Yeah. Let's talk about bringing in the bodies.
I want to remind listeners that an eyewitness saw a flash of light. Now, yes, the
handling television
of the bodies,
coverage.
The handling of the bodies and the wreckage was extraordinary. Tell us about that.
Well, there was a lapse between the plane coming down at 10 p.m. Eastern Time on July 16th and its discovery and the removal of the bodies on July 22nd. There was more than 5 days. The bodies were found 7.5 miles, I believe it was northeast of Martha's Vineyard, in about 150 feet of water. The water is 52 degrees Fahrenheit, which preserved the bodies. They were still strapped in. They had their seat belts on. They were still in the fuselage. It took a number of hours to recover them. They were raised by a Coast Guard team at about 3 something in the afternoon of July 22nd. they were on land. They were landed at the Oceanographic Institute and Coast Guard base there, Woods Hole, that's what it's called, at approximately 4:30. Reporters were not allowed to even look at them. They were all zipped up in body bags. No one was allowed to have any contact or, you know, observation of the bodies.
How about autopsies?
They were taken, they were put in a white van, which the New York Times ran a photo of, and taken to the county mortuary, the county morgue, and between dusk and midnight, the autopsies were done. Now, something extraordinary happened here. Under Massachusetts law, the autopsies must be photographed. But Senator Kennedy, Senator Edward Kennedy, according to the New York Times, personally asked the mortuary, the morgue, not to photograph the bodies and the autopsies. No notes on those autopsies have ever been presented to the press, and no interviews have been allowed with the people who did the autopsies. The bodies were no sooner autopsied than less than 10 hours after being brought to land, they were burned. They were incinerated. The three adults and the fetus, the male fetus they found in the belly of John F. Kennedy's wife. This is extraordinary. It's destruction of evidence. It completely circumvents any chance of really investigating this case.
One of the points you make
These people are Catholics. They don't incinerate. They don't cremate. They bury. They believe that the body is the temple of the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And until 1963, cremation of Catholics was prohibited by papal law. And even now it's frowned upon, and the Kennedys would not normally have done it.
You also cite an unidentified observer of this extraordinary funerary procedure as saying, quote, the bastards got away with it. They got completely away with it.
If they were going to be charged with anything, what would it be? Littering?
Indeed.
Littering the ashes in the sea?
Reminds me of Nietzsche in a phrase that he had, a joke is the epigram on the death of a feeling. John, a couple of points I want to make. The assassination of President Kennedy was once again on the political front burner when, in the wake of the Balkans War, President Yeltsin gave President Clinton the KGB files on Lee Harvey Oswald, but he did so in a very public and ostentatious way. This could have been handled through channels, but at sub rosa, so nobody would have known.
Mm-hmm.
It was done in that kind of an ostentatious fashion, I think, to send a political message. And one more point I'd like to make is, and we haven't got time to discuss this in detail, but George Herbert Walker Bush's name crops up in the context of the Kennedy assassination in several different ways. He was reported to have filed a tip to the FBI on a John Bircher in Houston who turned out to be innocent, then was reported to have been sent by the CIA to Miami to gauge the reaction of the anti-Castro Cuban community.
Mm-hmm.
A CIA rebuttal on that was disproved by the Nation magazine, and most importantly, he was named to be director of Central Intelligence by former Warren Commission member Gerald Ford,
mm-hmm.
and in that position, he frustrated cooperation between the agency and the House Select Committee on Assassinations. This also from a man who was a close personal friend of George de Morenshield, the white Russian aristocrat and former Nazi spy, who was one of Lee Harvey Oswald's intelligence handlers. I would also point out...
Well, the whole connection to what happened to the father is very interesting, because when John F. Kennedy Sr. was autopsied, the autopsy notes were burned. The photographs and drawings that were made of the autopsy were altered. His brain disappeared. And here we have another case where photographs are not allowed and the bodies are immediately burned.
And I'd also point out, too, that there's a court case which has been in the courts, a lawsuit about with regard to the Contra drug trafficking filed by a former Green Beret named Bill Tyree.
Yeah, right.
And a mafioso, an Army colonel and CIA paymaster, and according to many sources, Oliver North's bagman named Albert Vincent Carone,
right.
filed some, in effect, deathbed affidavits in which he claimed not only was he in Dealey Plaza with a rifle, but that he made payments to Jack Ruby, among others. The point being that the JFK assassination is once again is in a court of law, someplace it never really was, with the exception of Garrison's investigation. There's another point I'd like to make, John, before I turn the rest of the interview over to you, that the summer of 1999 saw the deaths of more than one Kennedy, and I'd like to read an obituary that appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle on Thursday, August 12th of 1999, and this would put this death about 3 weeks after JFK Jr. This is a New York Times obit, Dateline New York, and headlined Anthony Stanislaus Radziwill. Anthony Stanislaus Radziwill, a television executive who received both Emmy and Peabody Awards, died Tuesday at New York Presbyterian Hospital. He was 40 and lived in Manhattan. Mr. Radziwill, the only son of Lee Bouvier Radziwill Ross and the late Prince Stanislaus Radziwill, had battled cancer for 10 years. He was close to his cousin, John F. Kennedy Jr., and each had been best man at the other's wedding. Talks about his broadcast career and goes on to say, the next year he joined ABC News as a producer on Primetime Live with Diane Sawyer and Sam Donaldson, specializing in investigative reporting. He worked on reports of the Rodney King beating, the Los Angeles riots, and the O.J. Simpson trial. His investigative work on neo-Nazism in the United States earned him a Peabody Award in 1990. Now, I would point out that that's right about the time he got cancer. Freedom of Information Act documents have indicated that the intelligence services of this and other countries have been able to give people cancer and assassinate them as early as 1954. I would also point out that there are numerous intelligence connections to the O.J. Simpson case, including evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of the Kennedy assassination. So one cannot draw any conclusions about the death of Anthony Stanislaus Radziwill at the ripe old age of 40, about 3 weeks after his cousin and best friend and best man at each other's weddings died. But I think that this is interesting, particularly in light of the fact that it removed someone who knew a lot about JFK Jr. Now, you pointed out that the wreckage also raises some very interesting questions. Tell us, John, about that.
Well, reporters were not allowed to examine the wreckage. It was brought in already boxed on Coast Guard cutters and then sent off to a secret, closed, high-security hangar at Otis Air Force Base, Massachusetts, where it now reposes. About two Saturdays after the examiner blanked out the original JFK story, they blanked out the second major story, which was the first official report from the government on the JFK Jr. plane crash. It came from the National Safety Transportation Board, and it said that the original investigation, which has been being done in secret, showed that there there was no evidence of sabotage, they said. They said that the engine apparently was functioning right to the last, and they said there was no great damage to the frame of the plane, but they did note that they had only gotten 75% of the wreckage and that they had nothing from the tail. The tail was completely missing. This was supposed to be the first of a series of bulletins on the plane wreckage. Reporters, as I say, have not been allowed to look at the wreckage. No photographs have been released. No further reports have been issued in the last 6 weeks. The last time that the National Transportation Safety Board was asked about the matter, they said, well, there may be no further reports of any kind. So they have buried John F. Kennedy, Jr., and they're trying to bury the story, and I think an investigation is called for.
Well, I certainly think that the questions that you've raised in your article, again, published in Anderson Valley Advertiser, L.A. Free Press, and now your Open City
publication. Now Open City, which is on the streets in San Francisco.
All righty. Well, this will...
35th anniversary issue.
Yep. This is...
Bring back the 60s.
Well, I think they're going to be bringing... They've already brought back some aspects, which is the assassinations. We'll see about the rest of it. But I want to stress that this is a story that I think people need to pay a lot of attention to, and I would also point out that with George Bush... George Herbert Walker Bush's name cropping up in the context of the assassination in several ways.
Well, there are people who are saying that it was suspicious that the son of the former head of the CIA should be running for president at exactly the time that John F. Kennedy Jr. Was being talked up for the Democratic nomination.
He took the words right out of my mouth.
Somebody who... It would not be unthinkable that if there was sabotage involved in this matter, that the person who did it was doing it on behalf of Bush.
That certainly
both father and son.
It certainly is something to bear in mind. Well, John, I want to thank you for your work, and I want to thank you for visiting with us today, because we are out of time, and your Open City publication promises to be asking these sorts of difficult questions.
We'll be out once a month from now on.
All righty. Well, I've been visiting with John Bryan, the publisher and editor of Open City. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.
Back again for the record, 175, Fortunate Son, Part 1, an interview with John Bryan about the death of JFK Jr. That was recorded in the summer of 1999. And again, about the Robert Kennedy assassination, AFA program number 9, for the record, 789. There is the Guns of November, among other programs. We have a great deal of information about the JFK assassination in the archives, all available for download for free. This concludes For the Record program number 892, the so-called Kennedy Curse. This is being recorded on February 28th of the year 2016. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.